The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Georgene Rice Show, the first live broadcast of 2020. James Blend is producing today's program. Clark Hilton is engineering. I'm glad to be back behind the mic. Intended to start the program with a brief 2019 in review, but do have some breaking news I want to bring to your attention. Missile attacks have targeted U.S. forces in Iraq, according to senior military sources. Iran is suspected and now has taken responsibility. Now, to put this into perspective, just listening recently to an interview with a member of the U.S. Senate, this is the 12th time in the last 60 days since Iran or its proxies have fired at U.S. troops in Iraq. So while this is in response to the death 3 days ago of Soleimani, this is something we have seen repeatedly. Now, in this context, it's perhaps more frightening, but this is, again, the 12th time in the last 60 days since Iran has, or its proxies, have fired on U.S. troops in Iraq. So this isn't as unusual or new as one might expect. The difference is, this time, Iran is taking responsibility. The 11th times previously, they had not. So again, to put it into a broader context, there are implications here. One is Iraqi sovereignty. Iran firing into Iraq, that obviously raises questions about Iraqi sovereignty and also targeting U.S. forces. Well, what we know now, missiles were fired early Wednesday. It's about 1:02 a.m., 1-something a.m. in the morning there now, in multiple locations across Iraq, according to U.S. military sources in the country, described it as a series of attacks on U.S. forces from Iran. The source says these are either cruise missiles or short-range ballistic missiles all over the country. So they're coming from a variety of locations, a variety of sources. The missile strike near Al-Assad Air Base in Anbar, where most of U.S. military personnel are housed, among other locations, are the targets. There was no immediate word on injuries or damage at this time. Now, meantime, Iran State TV claimed Tehran launched tens of surface-to-surface missiles at Iran Ain Assad Air Base housing U.S. troops. It came days after the Iranian Quds Force General Qassem Soleimani was killed in a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad's airport. A senior Iraqi commander of an Iraq-based militia also was killed. The U.S. blamed Soleimani for the killings of hundreds of American troops, 600-plus to be more precise, and said he was plotting new attacks just before his death. Well, Iranian officials and President Trump have traded threats since Soleimani's death, and more U.S. troops have been deployed to the region amid heightened tensions. Iran-backed militias in Iraq, known as the Popular Mobilization Forces, or PMF, have threatened revenge on American interests and personnel for those killings. On Sunday, Iraqi lawmakers approved a resolution to expel U.S. forces from the country. That resolution comes nearly 5 years after the government requested U.S. troops be deployed to Iraq after the Islamic State overtook vast swaths of the country. Well, the terror group has since been defeated, or at least subdued, Abdul Mahdi said, adding the mission has now evolved into a U.S.-Iran proxy war. Well, the truth is it's been little more than that from the very beginning. But nonetheless, that's where things stand today. And again, the headline, missile attacks targeting U.S. forces in Iraq, according to senior U.S. officials, making the indication that they are tens of surface-to-surface missiles focused on the Al-Assad air base in Anbar, among other locations. There's no immediate word on injuries or damages. And if there's more information on that, we'll certainly try to bring that information to you. Well, if you had to sum up 2019 in just a few words, fast and furious might be appropriate. This extraordinary year that was seemed to be on a nonstop 24/7 treadmill. It was nice for me for the last couple of weeks to be off that treadmill, not following the news. But with news events breaking so quickly throughout the year, one might after the other, that nobody had a moment to kick back and catch their breath on. One might be somewhat exhausted looking back. Well, on the world scene, we saw a precarious meeting between the U.S. and North Korea, violent protests in Hong Kong, nightmarish scenes in Syria, deadly, devastating storms that materialized out of nowhere. Closer to home, politics dominated the media. Republicans and Democrats crossed swords and impeachment hearings began. Meanwhile, two well-known actresses were snared in an education payola scandal, a major union went on strike, and 10 of the nation's top iconic figures passed. As the year ends, we can say without reservation that 2019 won't soon be forgotten. Although the truth is, if you were to go through some of the details, we've already forgotten many of them. Well, what are some of the issues America might anticipate in 2020? The new year and the kickoff of the Roaring Twenties 2.0, as they're now being called, policymakers are going to be faced with some incredibly important decisions. Several issues will take center stage. One of the to significantly shape our future, from immigration reform to college loan debt. Certainly one of the biggest will be the Senate impeachment of President Donald Trump, or at least the hearing. Although the outcome is nearly certain, there aren't enough Senate votes to remove the president from office, the issue will steal the air from other issues until the trial is concluded. Now, steal the air from other issues, as well as the campaign on the part of the Democrats trying to gain the nation's attention as they are vying for their party's nomination. Well, some issues likely to dominate this year. Each represents sort of a fork in the road, and the direction the nation chooses will be critical. First issue, immigration. The president could roll out a new immigration plan as we head toward the elections. In addition to trying to secure more funding for desperately needed border security, a part of the plan could include another attempt at creating a merit-based legal immigration system rather than one that's based primarily on family ties. A system that favors applicants with desirable job skills would shift legal immigration's focus from being centered on the desires of immigrants to being centered on the needs of the American people and our economy. A merit-based system, which has been talked about in 2019, also more easily allows patriotic assimilation, creating a more unified nation rather than one divided into special interest groups based on where we came from. Then there's election integrity. Yes, there's an election coming up this year. With the 2020 elections coming, citizens have to be assured that the electoral process for federal, state, and local elections is, in fact, fair. And although many on the left deny it, voter fraud exists. Even the U.S. Supreme Court has noted that voter fraud is a clearly documented part of our nation's history. Unfortunately, politicians and advocacy groups continue to fight laws that require an ID to vote. They've even sued states that have tried to purge voter rolls of people registered in multiple jurisdictions who could vote more than once in an election. Then there's education. Politicians have floated proposals of free college tuition for all and loan forgiveness for everyone carrying college debt. They are characterized as investments in our future, but the reality is they would be a suffocating financial burden on every taxpayer, especially middle and lower income citizens. There's also an inherent unfairness to forcing Americans who couldn't afford to go to college themselves to pay off the loans of those who could. One also has to question what kind of return taxpayers would get for that investment. Well, despite these issues, because federal loan money is handed out with little scrutiny as to students' ability to pay it back, colleges have had free rein to raise prices at rates often double that of inflation. In addition, more than a million people default on their loans annually, leaving taxpayers to pick up the tab. Free college tuition would only make things worse and, of course, would not be free. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show, winding our way through some of the issues we might face in 2020. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show, live and back in studio. 21 minutes after 4 o'clock is our time. Continuing to follow the developing story, missile attacks targeting U.S. forces in Iraq. We're hearing different numbers, some suggesting in the U.S. Military saying that there have been a dozen missiles, some as many saying as many as 30 missiles. We don't know that at this point, but ballistic missiles have been released. Damage assessments are underway inside Iraq. It's about 2 a.m. in the morning there now. The next thing to watch for is the response from the United States. It's quite clear that they've already chosen whatever sites they would target in response to these events. Launch sites of the missiles is probably at the top of that list. Oil refineries, platforms, that sort of thing as well. We'll continue to follow the event as it unfolds. Again, about 2 a.m. in the morning in Iran at this time. And of course, U.S. leaders are following the story and determining what the next response will be. Not altogether unexpected, as was promised some 3 days ago. So this does not come as a surprise to those in positions of authority, but certainly is concerning to those of us on the ground here at home. Well, just before the break, we were talking about some of the top issues America will face this year: immigration, election integrity, education, also China. Under the brutal governance of the Chinese Communist Party, China presents a combination of risks our nation has never before faced. Now, Chinese authorities direct attacks on our government cyber networks, steal the intellectual property of our companies, threaten the travel of ships and planes in and over international waters. This is a concern we'll see escalate over the next 12 months. The authoritarian regime is also spending enormous amounts of money to build up its offensive military machine. As U.S. policymakers start to pay more attention to China's threats, we can expect to see more recommendations for rebuilding America's military to keep China in check. Also, while the national security threat is very real because so many raw materials and finished goods come from China, the U.S. will continue attempting to build more positive trade relations with the country. It's sort of a schizophrenic approach, but a necessary one. Besides being good for Americans economically, a better trade relationship also serves as a deterrence to Chinese aggression, since there's little incentive to attack a major market for its goods. Also, some predictions of what could happen in foreign policy in this next year, or I should say in this year. In the world of foreign policy, no one knows the future, but trends can be spotted and their trajectories predicted. Five predictions, admittedly aggressive ones, concerning what might happen in foreign policy in 2020. Certainly at the top of the list as of now is what's happening between the United States and Iran, and whether or not there is a proxy war continuing and growing in Iraq. Also, cyber conflicts will become real world conflicts. And in fact, when it comes to Iran, if they want to damage the United States, that may be their most powerful tool. Well, the world of cyber is already crowded with national intelligence services, criminal syndicates, hackers, and pirates. In 2019, state and non-state actors alike have been engaging one another with increasing frequency and gusto, and there's no sign of this slowing down. Specifically, as the U.S. enters a presidential election year, low barriers to mounting digital interference campaigns and their promise of potentially significant impact will prove too tempting for several foreign governments and others who are seeking to cause havoc in our political process and beyond. U.S. leaders will also be under significant political pressure to identify and counter this interference and will be inclined to respond aggressively in defense of the nation's political institutions. This could, in turn, set off escalating responses that ultimately spill over into the world, the real world, politically, socially, and perhaps most significantly, economically. And then as cyber confrontations become more frequent and intense, the likelihood of escalation, a large-scale cyber attack, and miscalculation will increase. 2020 could very well be the year that we see, for the first time, a large-scale cyber attack that results in large-scale physical damage and significant loss of human life. For example, a recent cyber attack thought to have originated in Iran targeted a petrochemical plant in Saudi Arabia. It was intended to cause a large explosion that could have killed dozens. A coding mistake by the attackers is all that prevented the attack's success. And while a similar attack is unlikely to happen here at home, it could happen to one of our allies or partners and could still have significant implications for the American people. If it does, the U.S. will likely have a strong hunch as to who produced the attack, but much of the information will remain in classified channels. And then there's the possibility of, in the foreign policy realm, of more Chinese abuses. The world will continue to learn more about Chinese human rights violations and general misbehavior. Expect more reporting about the Uyghur detention camps in Western China and the Hong Kong protests to provoke strong reactions from the Western public. These reactions will shape the political contexts for ongoing trade and security negotiations with Beijing. And then the Aussies. Australia will continue to uncover rampant Chinese interference within its social, economic, and political sectors. Again, a prediction. Its government will galvanize on these issues, will want to mobilize an international coalition to confront Chinese aggression and interference. This effort may fail, however, due to European political and economic indifference and compromise and lack of leadership from the United States. And then, finally, European capitulation to China, which again, what happens in Australia may hinge upon. Many European countries are reaching a point of internal crisis as they lack strong technological industrial bases, face mounting public dissatisfaction for their failure to deliver on promised cradle-to-grave entitlements. Many of those countries will be tempted to make catastrophic security decisions in an effort to placate the public dissatisfaction and keep up with the technological advancements emanating from the United States and China. The trend has already been seen in Huawei's growing presence in Europe and in the fact that 23 European countries have signed agreements under Beijing's predatory Belt and Road Initiative. 19 of these countries are members of the European Union, and one of them, Italy, is a member of the Group of Seven. Now, the concern is, of course, that if Huawei or China has inroads into the technology in these countries, they can gain access to technology and portals into the United States and other European allies. 2020 could be a banner year for American foreign policy. One hopes it is, but even if it is, our nation will still face some serious challenges. And these five are just some that we should be prepared for looking forward toward the days ahead. Well, yesterday, of course, marked Epiphany. For liturgical calendar watchers and church history enthusiasts, Epiphany ranks as the third most important event of the church year, right after Easter and Pentecost. It was one thing for Israel's king to be born among Jewish shepherds and angels, quite another to have him revealed as the king of the Gentiles as well. Epiphany means revelation, and with the revelation of Jesus to the Magi, God's plan to save his chosen people turns out to be a plan to save the whole world. It is significant. By the time we get to Matthew 2, Jesus is a toddler. The family still resides in Bethlehem, where they're famously visited by a collection of exotic magicians from the East, described by tradition as three kings or wise men, easily the strangest guys to show up in the Gospels thus far. Scholars conclude that they were likely astrologers who, having checked their skies, determined an important king has been born who is worth checking out. Well, with the kind of fervor currently reserved for any royal birth, these astrologers trace a star toward Jerusalem, Israel's capital city. They drive straight to the palace, since that's where you'd expect a king of the Jews to be born. For the ancients, astrology was the best that science had to offer as far as the cosmos was concerned. It was a world where the earth sat at the center of the universe and stars and planets were thought to be alive. What did the Magi see up there in the sky that night? An astral anomaly, a blazing comet? We don't know. Well, scholars conclude that from the east probably meant the Magi hailed from Persia, Babylon, or Arabia, known as Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, nations whose significance to peace on earth is as important then as now. What were Arabs doing looking for a Jewish Messiah? Well, for serious Old Testament scholars and readers, this was not a surprise encounter. Isaiah, the prophet, saw it coming in chapter 60 of his book, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn." This is where we get the idea of that the Magi were kings. Isaiah goes on to foresee how the wealth of nations shall come to you, a multitude of camels shall cover you. This is how camels get into the story, the nativity scenes. And finally, they shall bring gold and frankincense and shall bring good news, the praises of the Lord, which is how Isaiah 60 gets linked to the Magi. Well, maybe the Magi knew something of Isaiah, which would have given them corroborating reason to follow the light to Jerusalem. They get to the palace, but don't find the king there. Well, the irony is unavoidable, and I wish time permitted to go into greater detail, but that date was yesterday, the 6th of January, Epiphany. If you're not familiar with that event on the liturgical calendar, I would encourage you to check it out. It is an important part of the Christmas story, as well as the story of the resurrection of the Savior. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, we're going to talk with Dr. Michael Brown, author of Job, The Faith to Challenge God. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
34 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Continuing to follow our breaking news story, apparently the missiles that were fired earlier today and ongoing, from what I understand, targeted U.S. military and coalition personnel in Al-Asad and Erbil. These are not new targets, so whether or not they were successful, again, damage assessments are ongoing. We'll continue to follow the story as more information is made available. Well, just as there was no man on earth like Job, there is no book on earth like the book of Job. Well, in this new commentary written by my next guest, biblical scholar Dr. Michael Brown, he brings Job to life for the 21st century reader, exploring the raw spirituality of the man, his extraordinary faith, his friends' theological errors, the mysteries of God's speeches, and the unique answers to the problem of suffering offered in the book of Job. Undergirded by solid Hebrew scholarship, but written with clarity for all serious students of Scripture, the commentary provides an important introduction to the study of Job, a new translation, a series of theological reflections, and additional exegetical essays providing in-depth discussion of key passages. We're talking about the book, Job, The Faith to Challenge God, a new translation and commentary by Dr. Michael Brown. Dr. Brown is president of Fire School of Ministry and has served as adjunct professor at seven leading seminaries. He holds PhD from New York University, hosts The Line of Fire, a daily talk show, and is the author of 36 books and more than 1,000 articles. He is considered a leading Messianic Jewish apologist and joins us today to talk about this remarkable book, Job, The Faith to Challenge God. Dr. Brown, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my joy to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, what for you has been most fascinating about the book of Job? I think many of us try to avoid it altogether because it can be confusing and one might dare to say depressing.
Yeah, when I was a new believer and I started reading through the Bible, Job got my attention. You know, the initial two chapters are amazing. Here's this righteous man, Job, and the devil challenges God, and everything is taken from Job, but he still worships. And then he curses the day he was born, the next chapter. But then the next two chapters, the first of the friends lovingly rebukes Job. And I thought, yeah, I like what he said. And then Job responds to the friend, and I thought, yeah, I like what he said. And then the next friend comes and rebukes Job, and I thought, well, I agree with that. And then I would agree with Job, and I thought, okay, there's something more going on here. And then Elihu comes on at the end, he kind of unannounced, this new guy, and he speaks for several chapters. And was he a good guy or a bad guy? Did he prepare the way for the Lord or get in God's way? And then God speaks, and instead of answering Job's questions, he talks about nature, he talks about these creatures, behemoth and leviathan, and then Job repents, and it's, well, and then God restores. So what is going on here? And yet, when you start to understand the book, as I said at the beginning of the introduction to the book, just as there's no man on earth like Job, that's what God said to Satan, there's no book like the book of Job. And when you begin to understand it and see the depth of Job's faith, and yet it was a faith that caused him to challenge God, and part of his challenge, God says, you were saying the right things about me, and on the other hand, God rebukes him. It's fascinating, it's relevant. And I think especially when people are afraid to ask questions and they think they're not being spiritual if they ask questions, this is a book that says, let's get it out because God knows what's really going on in the hearts anyway.
I think one of the things that's most challenging about the book of Job is the drama that plays out. In the story, Satan apparently has access to God. What does this tell us in terms of the negotiation, if I can use the term, that results in Job's suffering?
Yeah, well, the first question is, can Satan just do that to us? That's what Christians would worry about. Mm-hmm. You know, is it possible Satan is just going to come and do that to me? Obviously, we believe that on this side of the cross, with the death and resurrection of Jesus, that Satan would not have that kind of access to us because we have authority over him. At the same time, the larger message of Job is telling us that sometimes inexplicable things happen to righteous people. And we can't do what the friends did and turn around and say, oh, well, Job, you must be a terrible sinner. There's something wrong with you. And then we can't do what Job did to say to God, well, there must be something wrong with you. There's something more going on, and that's part of what we learn here. But what we have to understand is just as Satan is allowed to attack Job, that through history, there are things that happen to us, things that we go through, and we don't know why we were allowed to go through him. Why is Satan even around? Why didn't God just destroy him when he fell? Mm-hmm. There's something larger where God brings good out of this, and that God ultimately knew that in the end, although Job would go to hell and back, so to say, and suffer incredibly, that in the end, good would come out of it, even greater good, and Job would know God in a deeper way than he ever had. So what Satan means for evil, God intends for greater good.
Can you tell us the timeline of the book of Job? Some say it predates many of the books of the Bible, and where it's placed in the canonized scripture is sort of displaced. When did these events take place, and why is it important for us to understand the message of Job in understanding the challenge we face as believers and the opposition that we face as followers of Christ?
All right, so number one, the events of Job seem to be quite ancient, as in patriarchal times before there is a nation of Israel. Job and his friends are the picture painted of them as if they are non-Israelites living in ancient patriarchal times. That's when the events took place. But contrary to the idea that Job is the oldest book in the Bible in terms of when it was written, it's very clear that it was written much later. It may have been written close to the time of the Babylonian exile, thereabout. And we know this for quite a few reasons, that the actual writing of it, even though it uses kind of an ancient form of Hebrew, it's actually written much later. And it could even be tied in with the time of exile because of the problem of suffering that that raised. But what the book of Job is saying to every believer today is that you have the ability before God to be yourself in his presence. Yes, Job is rebuked for speaking wrongly about God, and that he calls him a tyrant and a monster and accuses God of being behind all the injustice and evil in the world. So he speaks wrongly about God and is rebuked for it. But on the other hand, one of the most amazing verses in the Bible, and I spent a lot of time on this, Job 42:7, God rebukes the three friends and says, "You did not speak what was right about me, as did my servant Job." So how did Job speak rightly about God? And the real answer seems to be that he knew that if God was truly the God he believed him to be, then these things should not be happening the way they did, that there must be some justice in God's universe. Otherwise, God was not the God that Job believed in. And that's telling me that ultimately, if you have really and truly trusted God with your life and believe him to be a good God, that goodness will be manifest, that you may pass through valleys and difficulties and challenges where it seems like God is not who you thought he was, but hang on and continue to worship him because he will demonstrate his goodness either in this world or the world to come.
You write about a coherent and redemptive theology of suffering. What do you mean by that?
Well, on the one hand, suffering by itself is negative. Nobody wishes disaster on a loved one. No one hopes for sickness and pain and hardship. And yet, in the book of Job, there is a theology of suffering. On the one hand, when you suffer for righteousness, Job was actually suffering because he was a righteous man. And when there is suffering for righteousness, your attitude towards it ultimately is different. Job became a target for Satan because he stood out on the earth as a righteous man. And Satan, the adversary, is challenging the Lord as if to say, you don't have any righteous people on the earth. You don't have any good people on the earth. No one is serving you without ulterior motives. They just serve you because of the benefits. So it is Job's righteousness and faith that single him out for attack. And yet what comes out of this is a greater intimacy with God and an understanding that suffering in itself can be negative, but can cause greater growth in character and in relationship with God as a result, and even a witness to a watching world.
How would you describe Job's response? Was he dismissive? Was he defiant? Perhaps a combination of the two? Ultimately, how would you describe his response to the events that were unfolding that affected not only him personally and his physical life, but his family as well?
So initially, he just worships. He worships the Lord, and that's all that he knows to do. He's not going to speak evil of him, and he's making clear, I serve God because he's God, and I do what's right because it's right, not because of the reward. As things go on, and the friends begin to speak, and the friends begin to challenge, and it's fascinating that the friends speak always in the third person about God. He's this, he's this, he's this. Job will often speak to God and address him. So he's absolutely defiant, but you could call it defiant faith. And that's why the subtitle of the commentary is The Faith to Challenge God. And I have a theological reflection, one of many in the back of the commentary, called Challenging God as an Act of Faith. And now this may sound very odd in the ears of Christians, because challenging God is a negative. We trust him, we worship him, we honor him, we know he's good, he rules, he reigns, he's king, he never does wrong, so therefore we praise him and worship him no matter what. There's also a side, though, of wrestling with God, mm-hmm. and that's what Job does. So he goes too far. He definitely sins, but there was a faith in his defiance. I think it's important people realize the Job of the poetic chapters, where he battles with his friends and with God, is just as much a man of faith as the Job in the opening chapters who just worshiped and said nothing else.
Mm. We're talking with Dr. Michael Brown. His latest book, Job, The Faith to Challenge God, a new translation and commentary. We're going to continue that conversation in just a few moments. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
50 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Michael Brown, author of Job, The Faith to Challenge God. It offers a new translation and commentary as well. Dr. R. Kendall said of the book, Dr. Michael Brown's commentary on Job is immensely learned, very readable. It will find its place alongside the best commentaries on Job ever written. And I would certainly agree. I think it's important to emphasize it's readable and approachable, but it certainly is rigorous in its approach as well. Let's talk a bit about Job's friends, his comforters, if you will. Job's so-called friends make some false assumptions about his suffering. What can we learn from them about their misunderstanding of the events that they were witnessing and their understanding of God in the broader context of what their friend once had enjoyed as a righteous man and now had been stripped of entirely?
Yeah, we can see that you can have a theological orthodoxy that does more harm than good. That for the friends, they only knew two options, that Job was a really righteous man, and therefore he was extravagantly blessed. Now he's extravagantly punished. He must be a really wicked man. And if you look through the Old Testament, the blessings and the curses, so blessings for obedience, curses for disobedience, the Psalms and Proverbs, it seems to reinforce this, that the righteous will be blessed and the wicked will be cursed. But there is more to the story than just that, which is why you have the rest of the Bible unfolding mm-hmm. these things, which is why you have the book of Job. But sometimes we can do that same thing. Oh, well, if that person, that Christian, they got in a car wreck, or the kids were killed, or this one died of cancer, they must be doing something wrong. Why do we say that? Sometimes we say it because our own faith is so fragile. We don't want to think that something bad could happen to us. Therefore, we have to demonize the other person. And that's what ultimately happened with Job. And the more they spoke against him and misrepresented God, then Job had to fight back. And the more Job fought back, then he started to sin with his lips. And then this confirmed to the friends, oh, he is a sinner. What should have happened is they should have sat with him. As has often been said, they were doing great until they opened their mouths. You know, they sit with him silently for 7 days. They were obviously true friends. They cared. Then what do you tell someone in suffering and agony? Say, we love you. We're here for you. You don't have to theologize at that moment. You don't have to quote scripture. You don't have to tell them, well, God is this. And maybe you can say, look, I know it makes no sense, and you must feel like God's a million miles away, but let's hold on together. We love you. That's the right response. And if someone has sinned and brought evil on themselves, that will become self-evident. If somebody robbed a bank and now the police are after you, okay, you'll find out you're suffering for your sins. But our default thing should be, don't do what the friends did. Show love, show solidarity, and say, let's hang on to God together and get through this.
And yet we still, having the witness of the book of Job, we still feel compelled to, in very short order, come up with reasonable explanations for events that a friend or family member is experiencing, whether that's to console ourselves or to somehow defend God. I'm not sure we learned the lesson from Job's friends. as we read the mistakes that they made in their effort to try to comfort him and make sense of events.
Yeah, one thing that's very common with us as believers is we want to have answers for everything and put things in a nice little box. And one of the great messages of the book of Job, and this is what God shows Job, it's not to bully him or intimidate him, but to say, Job, you really don't know how this whole thing runs. You know very, very little bit about the universe, about the world. You know very, very little. And that's where we need to have the confidence to say, I'm going to worship God even when everything seems to be going wrong. I'm going to worship God and praise him because he's good, even though it looks very dark right now. And there are critics, there are theologians, especially after the Holocaust, that don't like the end of Job because it's too happy. Wait a second. Now he lives happily ever after. Doesn't that undo the whole message? No, it doesn't. Because God will manifest his goodness either in this world or the world to come. And we will enjoy his kindness and his goodness and his love forever and ever. But that means that when I go through rocky times, when my experience seems to be the exact opposite, where the light that I was expecting becomes darkness, where the prayers we were sure were going to be answered come crashing down at our feet, that's where we learn from Job. God will be vindicated in the end, and he will show himself to be good.
One of the things that you point out in the book, Job, The Faith to Challenge God, is Job's oft-quoted phrase, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And you make the point that this is based on a false assumption. Where does he go wrong in that statement that is so often admired because it says that whatever happens, I'm going to continue to trust in God? Where did Job go wrong?
On the one hand, Job does say that when he's tried, he's going to come forth like gold. He says that in the 23rd chapter. But Job 13:15, if you look in 20 different English translations, you'll see the translations are all over the place. And really, when you read the chapter, what he wants to do is argue it out with God. And as I translate it, and you'll see others agree, that he's what he's saying here, look, he's going to kill me. I'm waiting for it expectantly, yet I will argue my ways to his face. And then he says, and this will work out for my salvation, since no godless person could ever come before him. So on the one hand, he knows if he's going to challenge God, he's going to die. But he feels if he could just get before God and argue his case, because there's justice in God's universe, God will bring things around in the right way. But then by the end of the chapter, he's like, it's never going to happen. There's no way that I'm going to have an audience with God. So there's truth and there's error. And we find that over and over in Job. We find it again in the 16th chapter where he feels sure there must be some heavenly witness, some mediator who will stand up on his behalf. Obviously, we think immediately of Jesus. And then Job 19, where his faith rises yet again, he goes, I know that my Redeemer lives. And that's the amazing thing in the midst of this agonizing faith battle, that he runs from God to God. He accuses God of being a monster, but then he turns and said, but I know my Redeemer lives. This is part of the majesty and wonder of the book of Job.
Mm. Now, at the end of the book, God steps in. He sets things straight. He speaks. What does he say that can be helpful to us as we try to make sense of suffering in the 21st century? In our time, well, we have the witness of Scripture, we have the indwelling Holy Spirit, we have a relationship with the high priest who sits at the right hand of the Father and ministers on our behalf. What can we learn from what God says to Job in our time?
Well, I don't know if you've ever been to a funeral and someone's holding a little baby there, and as you're in a state of mourning, you look up and you see that little life, and maybe those eyes look at you and there's that smile. God wants Job to see the beauty and the majesty and the intricacy and the care of his creation, to say, hey, Job, I don't just let random crazy things happen. There's an order, there's a plan, there's a beauty. It is who God is. For us, we look at the cross and we recognize in the midst of the madness, there is love demonstrated. And then these creatures, Behemoth, Leviathan, God ultimately has mastery over all the powers of darkness and the powers of chaos and will ultimately subdue them. God will subdue the storm. God will bring beauty out. This is who he is. And what we have to do in the midst of trials, some of which go on for days, some of which go on for decades, is remember the lessons of Job, remember the God of Job. And if we cultivate relationship with him, then we will see in the end, in this world and the world to come, we will see the reality of our faith and the fact that all the good that we believed about God was accurate and true.
Mm. I know how I would answer the question, but let me ask you, to whom, Job, the faith to challenge God is written? Is it for the serious follower of Jesus who wants to, who loves the scripture and wants to understand the book of Job? Or is this a more scholarly volume that's for those who are perhaps in a higher academic study?
Yeah, those in the higher academic study can use it and will learn from it, but I wrote it for everyone else. In fact, I wrote the whole thing and we realized it was too academic. I went and redid the whole commentary so that every interested student in the book of Job can dig in and learn and be changed.
Well, and again, I mentioned I know how I would answer the question, and I think you're absolutely right. It's approachable and understandable from for the rest of us. Again, we're talking about Job, the faith to challenge God, a new translation and commentary. Dr. Michael Brown, thank you so much for your work and for talking with us today.
Oh, and thank you for your interest. I really appreciate it.
Again, the book is published by Hendrickson Academic. Job, the faith to challenge God. News and traffic up next. We'll try to bring you the latest with air attacks in Iraq coming to U.S. military bases from Iran.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to the second hour of the Georgine Rice Show. James Blend is producing, Clark Hilton engineering today's program. Later this hour, we're going to hear from comedian Nazareth. He's coming back to the Portland area this Saturday night at Northwest Christian Church, the Tigard campus on Southwest Hall Boulevard. Tickets are available at kpdq.com. We'll give you an opportunity to hear from him as he anticipates his return to the Portland metro area. Well, of course, the top news story of the day, Iran has launched more than a dozen missiles into Iraq targeting U.S. coalition forces. We're being told that Al-Asad Air Base and Erbil are the targets of these missiles. The operation has been called Martyr Soleimani by the Iranians. We don't know at this point if they've been successful in their targets. These are not new targets, but this is the first time we've had ballistic missiles lobbed from Iran into Iraq. Usually proxies within the country have been used. They're targeting U.S. military forces and coalition personnel, again, at Al-Asad and Erbil. And it's an ongoing developing story. As more information is made available, we certainly will pass that along to you. But again, Iran has launched more than a dozen missiles into Iraq, targeting U.S. coalition forces, according to the Pentagon. Well, earlier today, the United States has bolstered its military resources in the Middle East. Netanyahu says that Israel should stay out of the fallout from U.S. Killing Soleimani. The leader of Iran's Revolutionary Guard threatened on Tuesday to set ablaze places supported by the United States over the killing last week of the top Iranian general Soleimani, responsible for more than 600 U.S. military deaths. In an airstrike ordered by President Trump, as U.S. military officials bolstered resources near the Middle East, the U.S. Air Force deployed 6 B-52 bombers to the region amid the rising threat from Iran. After Soleimani's killing, the threat was palpable on Tuesday as a sea of seemingly thousands of supporters reportedly chanted death to Israel when Iran's Soleimani vowed vengeance in the central square of Kerman, Soleimani's hometown, where his remains arrived to be buried. Tragedy struck during his funeral procession, however, when a stampede erupted, killing some 50 people, injuring 48 others, Iran State Television reported. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sought to distance himself from the U.S.-led airstrike that killed Soleimani, telling security cabinet members on Monday that Israel should stay out of it. Also on Monday, Defense Secretary Mark Esper and General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, attempted to quell confusion about a letter circulating from the U.S. military telling Iraq that it would be withdrawing troops from the region a day after Iraqi lawmakers approved a resolution calling to expel U.S. troops from the country. Both Esper and Milley called the unsigned letter a mistake and said the U.S. had no intention of withdrawing troops. Meanwhile, Senator Bernie Sanders ratcheted up his condemnation of the president's order of the airstrike that killed Soleimani, comparing it to Russian President Vladimir Putin assassinating dissidents. The 2020 presidential candidate made the comments in an interview with CNN on Monday. He was one of several Democrats who slammed the president's handling of the growing tension with Iran. 2020 presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren and squad members Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Representative Ilhan Omar all said Trump was threatening to commit war crimes by vowing the U.S. would target 52 Iranian sites, some of which important to Iran's culture, if the nation attacked America. The president has since said that he has no intention of moving in that direction. Also, a group of Republicans on Monday moved to introduce a resolution allowing the chamber to dismiss articles of impeachment that have yet to make their way to the Senate against the president for lack of prosecution, as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi continues to delay sending the case for trial. The resolution, led by Senator Josh Hawley, a Republican out of Missouri, specifically would update Senate rules to allow the chamber to bring a motion dismissing the articles for lack of prosecution once the House has withheld articles for 25 calendar days or more. Meanwhile, former National Security Advisor John Bolton said Monday that he would testify in an impeachment trial against Trump should he be subpoenaed by the Senate. Well, the Pentagon is scrambling. There's been no decision to leave Iraq and some confusion about whether or not that was a plan. And the media, impressed and sobered by the tears of Soleimani's funeral, seemed to be taking the side that he was not a terrorist, but someone to be pitied. A stampede at the funeral of slain Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force Commander Soleimani has left at least 50 people dead, over 200 injured. And FBI gun background checks linked closely to weapons sales recorded the second highest month ever in December, propelling 2019's count to the most since the National Instant Criminal Background Check System began in 1998. U.S. implements a plan to send Mexican asylum seekers to Guatemala, and Iran has terrorists embedded inside the United States and across the border, according to The Federalist. The terrifying possibilities for an Iranian cyber attack, the Washington Examiner reports, could be the most effective way of retaliation. And Harvey Weinstein's charged with rape, sexual battery in Los Angeles over 2013 allegations, faces bicoastal charges. Well, on this day in history in 1999, for the second time in history, an impeached American president goes on trial before the Senate as President Bill Clinton faces charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. On this day in 1789, America holds its first presidential election as voters choose electors who, a month later, would select George Washington to be the nation's first chief executive. On this day in 1904, the Marconi International Marine Communication Company of London announces that the telegraphed letters CQD would serve as a maritime distress system or call. It would later be replaced by SOS. On this day in 1927, commercial transatlantic telephone service is inaugurated between New York and London. And in 1953, President Truman announces in his State of the Union message to Congress that the United States has developed a hydrogen bomb. In 1959, the United States recognizes the new government of Cuba 6 days after Fidel Castro led the overthrow of the previous president. And on this day in 1972, Louis F. Powell Jr. and William Rehnquist were sworn in as the 99th and 100th member of the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1979, Vietnamese forces capture the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh, overthrowing the Khmer Rouge government. On this day in 2004, President George W. Bush proposes legal status, at least temporarily, for millions of immigrants improperly working in the United States. And finally, on this day in 2015, masked gunmen stormed the Paris offices of Charlie Hebdo, a French newspaper that had caricatured the Prophet Muhammad, methodically killing 12 people before escaping. Well, the U.S. airstrike on Thursday night that killed Iranian General Qassem Soleimani was a bold and decisive effort to remove a key Iranian military terrorist leader at a time when Iran appeared to be poised to escalate the crisis in Iraq by plotting an imminent attack, in quotes, according to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Soleimani was the mastermind behind Iran's low-intensity warfare and terrorist campaign against the U.S. and its allies for many years. As the leader of the Quds forces, the elite special operations wing of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Soleimani essentially served as Iran's viceroy for Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. He rose to prominence inside Iran and in the region by supervising Iran's expanding network of surrogate militias, terrorist groups, and radical Islamist allies. His Quds force orchestrated the formation, arming, training, and operations of a foreign legion of Iraqi, Syrian, Lebanese, Afghan, Yemeni, and other militant groups that Tehran has deployed to advance its imperial agenda and to export Iran's Islamic revolution. Iran's long has used surrogate militias to do its dirty work in Iraq. One of the terrorists killed along with Soleimani was Abu Mahdi al-Mahamdas, the leader of the Kitab Hezbollah, or Brigades of the Party of God. Like Soleimani, he was designated as a terrorist by the United States. He was convicted and condemned to death in absentia in Kuwait for his involvement in the 1983 bombings of the U.S. and French embassies in Kuwait City. Well, this radical Iraqi militia, modeled on Lebanon's Hezbollah terrorist militia, was formed in 2007 as a proxy group under the direct command of Soleimani's Quds force. His confederate was one of Iraqi's militias that the Quds force employed to kill more than 600 U.S. troops in Iraq from 2003 to 2011, according to the Pentagon. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
20 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Coming up later, in fact, in our next segment, have a brief conversation with Comedian Nazareth. That's just his name, Comedian Nazareth. It's not Nazareth Smith, it's Nazareth Johnson, it's just Nazareth. Anyway, he's coming back to Portland this Saturday night at Northwest Christian Church in Tigard on Southwest Hall Boulevard. Tickets are available at kpdq.com. And if you want to start the year off with some good, clean humor, and to get a good belly laugh in, you might want to join us. That's, again, 6 o'clock p.m. This Saturday at Northwest Christian Church, the Tigard campus. Go to kpdq.com for more information about that. Well, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today he has the votes to start an impeachment trial even without an agreement on potential witnesses once the chamber receives the articles from the House. That's a big once. We have the votes, McConnell told reporters. The vote would kick off phase one of the president's impeachment trial, while the issues of witnesses would come up later and involve intense discussion, McConnell went on to say. Well, the GOP leader notified Republican senators at their weekly lunch that he has enough votes to proceed, meaning a simple majority of 51 votes, even as Democrats urged McConnell to accept their demands to seek certain witnesses' testimony. Well, Democrats amplified those demands after a key figure in the impeachment inquiry, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, said he'd be willing to testify if subpoenaed. But McConnell has maintained all along that he wants to model the impeachment trial for Trump after that of former President Bill Clinton by dealing with potential witnesses after the trial begins. And even as McConnell claims the votes to be able to proceed, he insists the chamber first needs to receive the articles of impeachment from the House. Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been holding on to those charges ever since last month, hoping to extract favorable terms for the trial. It's time for Speaker Pelosi to get on with it or get out of the way, Senator John Brasaro said on Tuesday. Their turn is over. They've done enough damage. It's the Senate's turn right now to render sober judgment, McConnell said on the Senate floor last week, referring to House Democrats. A developing story, at least we hope it's developing, and we'll move forward at some point in the not-too-distant future. Meanwhile, House Intelligence Committee Republicans are investigating the Intelligence Community Inspector General for his handling of the Ukraine whistleblower complaint, including potential inconsistencies in his testimony before the panel as part of the Trump impeachment inquiry. Committee's ranking member Devin Nunes first told investigative reporter Sarah Carter earlier this week that the panel has an active investigation into Intelligence Community Inspector General Michael Atkinson. A source familiar with the committee's investigation on Tuesday went into further detail, saying that Republicans are looking into the ICIG's handling of the whistleblower complaint that sparked the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The veracity of his testimony about the whistleblower complaint and the explanations he offered for changes made to the ICIG's guidance on accepting secondhand information. In August, Atkinson received a complaint from an individual raising concerns about Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky, in which he pressed Kiev to launch an investigation into the dealings of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden in Ukraine, as well as issues related to the 2016 presidential election. The president's request came after millions of dollars in U.S. military aid to Ukraine had been frozen, which Democrats argue show a quid pro quo arrangement. Trump has denied any wrongdoing. Republicans for weeks have complained that the whistleblower made contact with Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff's staff in advance, though Schiff has downplayed the nature of that contact. Whether Republicans are looking further into that contact as part of their review is unclear, but since last fall, they've specifically challenged intelligence community officials over changes to a key form that dropped a requirement for firsthand information and whistleblower complaints. The White House released a declassified version of the complaint, which revealed that the whistleblower's concerns stemmed from secondhand accounts from more than half dozen U.S. officials. After the form change was first noticed in media reports, Atkinson said in a lengthy statement that the whistleblower had actually filled out the older version of that form, which retained the requirement that whistleblowers have firsthand information. The ICIG revealed that the whistleblower had said he or she had firsthand information as well as secondhand information, but it was unclear what the firsthand information was. Well, the declassified complaint, though, stated, "I was not a direct witness to most of the events described. However, I found my colleagues' accounts of these events to be credible because in almost all cases, multiple officials recounted fact patterns that were consistent with one another." Republicans had previously questioned whether the timing of the form revision was related to the Ukraine complaint. And in a reversal, the Justice Department has recommended up to 6 months of prison time for ex-National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, claiming he has refused to accept responsibility for his actions. Given the serious nature of the defendant's offense, his apparent failure to accept responsibility, his failure to complete his cooperation in and his affirmation efforts to undermine the prosecution of ex-Flynn associate, whose name I won't attempt to pronounce, the government recommends that the court sentence the defendant within the applicable guidelines range of 0 to 6 months of incarceration, federal prosecutors wrote in a sentencing memo today. The filing represents a stark change from a prior Justice Department recommendation, which suggests that Flynn receive a sentence at the low end of the guidance range. Federal prosecutors, in earlier suggesting that Flynn not serve in any prison time, had cited his cooperation with other federal cases, including special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe. But Flynn's sentencing has since dragged on for months and faced numerous delays. The case cited Tuesday involved a former Flynn associate accused of illegal lobbying. His conviction was later tossed. Perhaps most significantly, Flynn's defense attorney, Sidney Powell, has aggressively fought back in recent months, pushing to have his prosecution dismissed and making a range of allegations against the government. And the Planned Parenthood Federation of America aborted 345,672 distinct individual human babies developing in utero during the 2018 fiscal year, the organization's annual report shows. Now, that's the most recent number that we have available. Planned Parenthood's 2018-29 annual report shows that the organization performed 12,915 more abortions during the 2018 fiscal year than the organization did between 2017 and 2018. The nation's largest abortion provider performed 345,672 abortions between the 1st of October 2017 and September 30th of 2018, as opposed to the lower number for fiscal year 2017. Abortions made up 95% of Planned Parenthood's pregnancy resolution services, according to Susan B. Anthony List. The new report also shows that the organization provided 9,821,548 services to 2.4 million patients during the 2018 fiscal year. The largest amount of services that Planned Parenthood performed in this time period were 4,960,598 sexually transmitted disease testing and treatment services, totaling about 50% of the services the organization offered. They provided 4,279 adoption referrals between 2018 and 2019, about 0.44% of the services the organization provided during that time period. For every one of these adoption referrals, the SBA list, Susan B. Anthony list, points out that Planned Parenthood performed almost 81 abortions. Well, apparently Hollywood can't take a joke. At the annual Golden Globes, an awards show for both movies and television on Sunday night, host comedian Ricky Gervais was actually funny, lampooning Hollywood in general and its woke culture in particular. "Let's have a laugh at your expense," he said at the opening of his monologue at the Globes' 77th award ceremony presented by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. "Remember, we're all going to die soon and there's no sequel." Well, it was quite a performance. Though it's clear that while some celebrities laughed along with the jokes, many others were not amused and had uncomfortable reactions. During the course of his monologue, Gervais joked that this would undoubtedly be his last awards show, so he didn't care if he offended people. Well, his speech ended up being a phenomenal takedown of an overly political and absurdly left-wing Hollywood that's become obsessed with self-righteous crusades such as the Me Too movement, or with bemoaning the supposed lack of racial and gender diversity in movies. Well, Gervais said that he couldn't begin the show with a rundown of celebrity deaths in 2019 because when I saw the list of people who died, it wasn't diverse enough. He then mocked the entertainment industry for being shamelessly transactional despite its moralistic pretensions. Apple roared into the TV game with The Morning Show, a superb drama about the importance of dignity and doing the right thing, made by a company that runs sweatshops in China, he said. So you say you're woke, but the companies you work for, Apple, Amazon, Disney, if ISIS had a streaming service, you would be calling your agents. He also poked fun at the smug yet clueless way Hollywood talks about it, talks down to everyone, saying you're in no position to lecture the public about anything, he said. You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg. Gervais concluded his monologue by making an appeal for award recipients to drop the political lectures. Don't use this as a platform to make political speech. You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. What was particularly great about Gervais' monologue is that Hollywood was exposed on its own turf. Now, he is by no means a conservative. He is a liberal, but he's also a comedian, and they seem to be more concerned about the freedom of speech and the freedom in general that we have enjoyed historically in this country, and it was refreshing to hear him speak. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, we'll hear from another comedian, Nazareth. He's coming to Portland this Saturday. All the important details up next.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, we're back. If you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, as I mentioned, there's something coming to the Portland metro area that you need to be fully aware of, and that's coming up on Saturday, January 11th. Nazareth is returning. Now, you know you've really made it when you're just known by your first name. It's not Nazareth Smith or Nazareth Johnson. Nazareth is a comedian who's been here to the Portland area. In fact, 1 year ago, the same date that he's returning here to Northwest Christian Church in Tigard. And we're just excited that comedian Nazareth is returning after his sold-out show last year at this time. So he originally came from the Holy Land, has been honing his talents as a comedian for 25 years, has finally got it right. He joins us today to talk about the special night of comedy that's coming up this Saturday night. Nazareth, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate that. I am excited to come back, and hopefully the weather is not as cold.
Well, can't make any promises there. So bring a heavy jacket.
I'm from California. Anything under 50 is evacuation weather for us.
Be prepared to evacuate. We're excited that you're coming back, and my understanding is, in fact, I've invited him to join us for this conversation. My understanding is James Blend is going to be a part of your show this Saturday?
That's one of my rules. It's like, if I said, if you want me to come to Portland, you need to open the show for me. And last year, he opened for 10 minutes, and he did a great job. Then I took over, and I got to be honest, nobody knew that in the audience. But in the green room, I was laying on the floor. I was very sick. I don't know what happened, a virus or something, but I flew in the morning. I couldn't even walk, but I flew in, and 7 o'clock, right when it was time for me to go on stage, I said, Lord Jesus, I just want your strength. And we had a great time, almost a standing ovation, I think we had. And this year I am healthy. I'm excited. We're going to do some new material and people going to laugh. I love to see, Georgina, I love to see people laugh because it's great for them. We are living in a time where everybody's anxious, stressed, scared. So it's doing something for themselves. Say, hey, I'm going to do something for me this year. I'm going to take time. I'm going to go laugh for an hour and a half.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, how do you gain the confidence that, I'm funny enough to entertain an audience of people I've never met. I mean, that sounds terrifying to me. When James opened for you last year, I felt like a mother, you know, worried about her son and his first recital. How do you gain the confidence that, yeah, this is not only funny, but this is going to be funny enough to amuse an audience in Portland?
30 years, 4,000 shows, and I think, I don't know. The only thing I know about my car is I can put the gas in the gas tank. I don't do anything around the house. I always have handy people do that. All I know in the last 30 years is how to do comedy and how to read my Bible. That's the two things I can share from the Word of God. I can do comedy, a full-time comedian. So, yeah, I take my craft seriously. Every year I want to be a better Nazareth than I am the year before. So really, I take a lot of time and a lot of effort to get better. So it becomes a technique to where you get the audience to laugh and to just, relax, put their wall down, enjoy themselves, to let them know, hey, I'm not here to say anything that's going to offend you. I'm not here going to say something that's going to be blue or dark or your daughter or your grandma is going to be offended at. I'm just going to have fun. And for me, my goal is to make people laugh. And then at the end, just share the joy of Jesus with them.
Yeah.
Boom. That's it.
And you do such a great job at that. I remember the first time I heard your comedy was at a pastor's appreciation event. And I have to admit, I started out a little bit skeptical. Okay, where is he going to go with this? I was so impressed. And I was thrilled that you came back shortly after that event. It seems to me that comedians have to be some of the more deep thinkers and observers in our culture, because you not only are aware of what's going on, but you see sort of underneath it some of the threads that merit our laughter and help us to kind of put us at ease through some of the challenges that we face.
You know, I hear that a lot, and you try to be humble about it. But people were saying, like, you know, comedians are the philosophers of our day. They're the ones that see things but say it in a way that kind of catches people, make them laugh. If we shared it with seriousness, what we see and how we think life is, you know, weird and crooked, then people might not laugh or they might not read what we say. But when we do it with humor, people really get impressed by it, and it affects them, and it, you know. So, yeah, I mean, all the comedian friends I know, we're all in high IQs, because you have to be to know, you know, to look at life, to look at things different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe we could be just weird people that never...
Or a combination of both.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes I feel that, yes.
I do feel like we're different kind of thinkers, Nazareth, in the sense that we're always observing the world around us, and I don't know that everybody always is. It's kind of one of those things where you're almost always looking for the joke, but at the same time, you have a different perspective on watching the world.
Okay, is this Lee talking?
This is James.
James Vine, okay. See, you guys sound the same on radio. Everybody on radio sounds the same, except for Georgina, of course, sounds a lot more feminine than that.
Thank you.
But yeah, James, you know, we do. I was trying to figure out if that's Lee or James. So what was the question again? Oh, that ruins my life.
Well, just the observation that there's a different kind of thinking involved when you do comedy, that your observation skills are always, no matter what the situation, they're always watching the world in ways that not everybody is.
You're right. We're like, we feel sometimes like we're outside of ourselves looking in at the world, what we're doing, how we're saying things, what people saying to us. And I just, like this morning, I was like, someone was saying like a big ticket item, like a car. I was like, what is a big ticket? You never go to get a ticket to buy a car. A big ticket item is when you park the car in the wrong place. That's what a big ticket item. So I'm just thinking this thing this morning. It's not a joke, yeah, but that's how we look at life.
That's how you see the world. Well, I want to remind our listeners that you're going to be here on Saturday. That's the 11th of January, 6 o'clock p.m. at Northwest Christian Church in Tigard on Southwest Hall Boulevard. You can go to kpdq.com for all the important details and to purchase your tickets. If you need a good laugh to start out the new decade, the new year, this is a great way to do that. Nazareth has become a favorite to KPDQ and Fish listeners here in the Pacific Northwest. So we're just delighted that you're coming back. You know, sometimes I look at comedians like musicians, because it's not just a matter of telling a joke or seeing something in a humorous way. The timing is important. You have to know when to pause. You really have to kind of choreograph and orchestrate the way you communicate. And that takes a real skill. Do you see yourself as kind of a musician?
We do look ourselves as artists. Any answer other than that will make James nervous on Saturday, but you don't need that. But yes, you're right. You know, we look at the whole show. We look at who's in the audience, what age group, what's that, what kind of material, what's going on in the world right now. And then you start writing material that really not only can be funny, but people can relate to it, you know. And then with me as a Christian, who at the end, I want to bring the joy of Christ at the end, just encourage people. So I like to pick material that actually lifts people up. And you know, when I do secular comedy or, you know, mainstream club, comedians who are not crazy go, how can you do that? Comedy is about, you know, being, you know, things going wrong, being depressed. It's about problems, about tragedy. How can you make it positive? And I go, I just look at, you know, how my life is going, what God is doing in my life, and I share that. And there's great news. That's why I want to tell the listeners, you know what, if you know someone, a friend, a coworker, a relative who's really having a hard time or maybe down or stressed or anxious, that would be a great way to gift and say, hey, you know what, I got you a ticket. Come with me. Let's laugh together. You know, some people want to, you know, they have a group of, you know, their life group or their Bible study group, and they go, hey, let's go laugh this Saturday together. And if you're a parent and go, you know what, I should bring my family because maybe my kids haven't seen me laugh in the last years. I've been just, don't do this, don't do that. So that's a good way to see the family laughing together. So you guys putting this event is really, you're helping the community.
Yeah, absolutely. Great suggestions. And I have to say that Nazareth is so masterful at combining the humor with the important things in life. You're going to have a great time this Saturday, 6 o'clock p.m., Northwest Christian Church. Go to kpdq.com for all the important details. Nazareth, we're looking forward to having you here. And thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much. And James, I'm looking forward to see you perform. Thank you.
And vice versa. Vice versa.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you Saturday. Bye-bye.
All right. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We're going to take a quick break to wrap things up.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the final segment of The Georgene Rice Show. Taking a look at the remainder of this week, our first week in the new decade, we'll be talking on Wednesday with Dave Bauer, author of The Gospel of the Son of God, An Introduction to Matthew. The book is published by InterVarsity Press, and of course, Matthew is one of the four Gospels. We'll talk with Dave Bauer about that. On Thursday, we'll talk with Cy Gart, the author of The Works of His Hands, A Scientist's Journey from Atheism to Faith. That book is published by Kriegel, and he'll be, my guest on Thursday. Looking forward to that. And then, of course, on Friday, as has been the tradition here for many years, Friday, we're going to take a look at the lighter side of the news, and that will be the first time in this new year that we'll seize that opportunity. Looking forward to spending a little time focusing on all of that. Of course, if there is breaking news, we'll certainly break in and we'll cover the day's headlines early in the program as well. So we'll try to do it all. Well, many of you I know have been praying for Lois Irene Evans, the beloved wife of Tony Evans, who's a longtime broadcaster here on KPDQ. They were married for 49 years. He's the founder of she's the founder of Pastor's Wives Ministry. She passed away on the 30th of December of biliary cancer. She was 70 years old. And if you know anything about Tony Evans, if you know anything about his family, his remarkable children, you know she was a pivotal and significant part of that ministry. Tony is the senior pastor of Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship in Dallas. He shared the news on Facebook. Just before the sun came up this morning, he wrote, "At the time, the love of my life transitioned from earth and watched her first sunrise from heaven." Now, it came as no surprise. We understood some weeks back that her condition was terminal, so this was not a surprise, although it's always a disappointment when we're separated, when we're parted from our loved ones, even if it's just for a season. She was with her husband and the couple's four children when she died on Monday, and this was December the 30th. As she slipped away, Tony Evans wrote, "As she slipped away, we told her how much we love her, how proud we are of her, and how thankful we are for the life she has lived. We are what we are because of her." Well, Priscilla Shire, the best-selling author, actress, and the Evans' daughter, tweeted, "Good night, my beautiful, beloved mommy. I'll see you in the morning." Well, the Evans' son, Christian, a music artist Anthony Evans Jr., he posted, "I love you forever, Mommy." Southern Baptist Convention President J.D. Greer also expressed his condolences on Twitter, "Grieving with you and your family, Dr. Evans." He tweeted, "Your and Mrs. Lois's life and ministry have been an almost incalculable blessing to many of us." Marshall Asbury, president of the National African American Fellowship of the SBC, the Southern Baptist Convention, and pastor of Antioch Baptist Church in Fairfax Station, Virginia, shared with condolences with Baptist Press, saying, "Lois Evans has been a picture of a loving wife, mother, and Christian woman." He told Baptist Press on the 2nd of January, that was Thursday, "Lois Evans' strong support of her husband enabled him to do all he did. They truly served well as a team. The Evans family has touched countless lives around the world." Well, there was a viewing earlier on Monday, Monday at Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship, and she was laid to rest later in the day. "We are grateful for your thoughts and prayers," Pastor Evans wrote. "Many have asked how to help during this time. In honor of Lois, I would also love for you to consider sending flowers this week to your pastor's wife. Lois loved receiving flowers, but also loved giving them because her passion was ministering to pastors' wives and making sure they felt loved and cared for. Your gift of flowers in her memory would be a gift to us as well." Well, in lieu of flowers, he suggested continuing the ministry of pastors' wives that was dear to her heart by contributing to the Urban Alternatives Pastors' Wives Ministry. Again, at age 70, Lois Irene Evans, beloved wife of Tony Evans for 49 years, founder of Pastors' Wives Ministry, passed away December 30th of biliary cancer. She was 70. Well, they tell us next week could mark the first period of time this winter when forecasters will be considering a snowy forecast. Well, snow levels over mountain passes should start lowering during the coming weekend, and the air in the Willamette Valley next week will be cold enough for possible snow. Well, a Friday cold front bringing rain and wind to Portland and snow to the Cascades above 3,000 feet will be the swinging door that opens, allowing cold air this weekend and much of next week. What that means for us who are non-meteorologists, cold Arctic air will gather in Canada over the coming days and possibly spill southward over the Northwest much of the next week. The current forecast models show air cold enough for sea level snow on Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. And while a snow event is not a guarantee, next week will mark the first period of time this winter when forecasters will be considering a snowy forecast. So it could happen. I was at Bible Study Fellowship this morning. I was in children's ministry holding the cutest little baby you'd ever seen. And we started a conversation. It was the first I'd heard the possibility of snow next week. So just a little heads up on that. The trend to below normal temperatures expected for next week could last through the first week of February. So this is a season that we're looking toward. If Portland is going to see a snow event this winter, the coming 3 or 4 weeks will likely be the best opportunity for that. Now, whether Portland does see snow or not, ski resorts are finally starting to see some impressive mountain snowfall. Just this morning, Timberline and Meadows reached a 50-inch snow base for the first time this season. That's going to make up for what's been a pretty slow start to the snowpack season this winter. So make note of that. We could have some snow on the ground in the next week or perhaps in the next few weeks following. Now, I know forecasters vary in terms of what their predictions are, and we're not being told there's going to be a snowpocalypse as of yet. I expect that might be coming up at some point in the future, but we'll keep our eyes on what's actually happening and try to keep you up to date as well. Well, as you may have had the opportunity to hear my conversation in the previous segment with comedian Nazareth, he's coming to the Portland area this Saturday. Want to encourage you to go check out the details and to purchase your tickets at kpdq.com. Nazareth has become something of a favorite here in the Pacific Northwest, and he's returning after his sold-out performance last year. You can get your tickets for this special night of inspiring comedy, suitable for the whole family. So again, that comedy night with Nazareth is coming up this Saturday, 6 o'clock p.m., about an hour and a half show, at Northwest Christian Church, the Tigard campus on Southwest Hall Boulevard in Tigard. Again, comedian Nazareth returns after his sold-out performance last year. And by the way, opening for Nazareth, James Blend. And I don't know, I'm not going to be on the platform. I won't be speaking. I'm not part of the show, but I'm nervous because James is going to be performing a comedy routine. I don't know where the guts come from to stand up on a platform for the sole purpose of making people laugh. Now, James has actually had a background in comedy. He's taken classes. He's done some stand-up comedy. So this is not new to him. But I feel like, you know, kind of the mom who's attending her son's recital, that you're just concerned, are they going to bomb? Or is he going to make, you know, is he going to hit middle C at the right time? Anyway, you have an opportunity to see and hear James Blend opening for Nazareth on Saturday, January the 11th, 6 o'clock p.m., Northwestern Christian Church, or rather Northwest Christian Church, the Tigard Campus. Again, I just feel a little bit nervous. Also, tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with Dave Bauer, author of The Gospel of the Son of God, an introduction to Matthew, which is itself, of course, a gospel. The book is published by InterVarsity Press. I want to thank James Blend for producing, Clark Hilton for engineering today's program, and thank you for making the Georgene Rice Show part of your day and your new year. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at @GRiceShow. And like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.